Hi friends, it's Brittany. Before we dive into today's episode, I have a quick ask for you. I need your help. I'm doing a short listener survey to get to know you a little bit better. Who's tuning in? What do you love? And how I can keep Conscious Pathways fresh, meaningful, and aligned with what you need. It won't take more than 5 minutes, and your feedback means so much to me. It helps me grow and helps this podcast to grow with you. You'll find the link in the show notes, and I would be so grateful if you took a moment to share your thoughts. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening. And now let's get into the episode. Hi, and welcome to Conscious Pathways, the podcast where we explore the intersection of education and social justice through transformative conversations. I'm your host, Brittany, and I am so excited that you are joining me for quite another episode of Conscious Pathways. Today, I am joined by Dr. Tunette Powell, who is a mother of three boys, an activist mama, equity practitioner, and storyteller who has published several books and papers on issues of community, race, racism, and self-induced collective trauma. Dr. Powell is a director of parent and family-centric partnerships at the Children's Equity Project at Arizona State University. She currently serves as a board member of the Youth Mentoring Action Network, a youth-building organization facilitating transformative mentoring, education, and wellness opportunities for young people across the globe. Dr. Powell, who earned her PhD in education at the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, has committed her scholarship and advocacy program to disrupting system-induced collective trauma and centering struggle and joy in historically and contemporarily marginalized communities. My conversation with Tunette was so empowering and beautiful. We talked about freedom dreaming. We talked about the state of education and what we imagine the state of education will look like in the future. We talked a bit about punitive discipline practices and the origins of that. Y'all know I love talking about punitive discipline practice and why it's wrong. So I'm surprised we could fit this whole conversation in an hour because I just got so excited about every little topic we brought up. She's so knowledgeable and just wonderful. So I'm so excited to share this conversation. So let's jump into it. Hello, hello, and today I am joined by Dr. Tunette Powell. Welcome to Conscious Pathways.
Yes, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I'm so excited to have you here. I was doing all my research, so I was looking at your background, what you've studied, the things that you've done, and you are such just an amazing human being. And I'm so excited to just talk to you and hear your insights and share your thoughts with my audience. I'm so stoked.
Yes, thank you.
So one question I always ask my guests is, how did you get your start in education and who was your inspiration? How did we get here?
Yeah, I love that question. I think it's such a powerful question. And I want to begin saying that, you know, I think that I was in education before I give you this mm-hmm. starting point. But I think what kind of just immersed me in it, where I knew this was the path, was my oldest two sons. But I should add that before their lives intersected with mine and we found ourselves in education, I was early career, thought I'd be a journalist. And on the days that I was off of working as an editorial assistant at a newspaper, I would substitute teach. And I absolutely love substitute teaching. I would go into alternative schools and schools where they had deemed the students as bad and at mm-hmm. risk and all of these things. And it was the best setting, the most mm-hmm. perfect setting, you know, that it was filled with so much love and energy and joy. And so I had a passion then, but I was still dead set on something else, that I would be doing mm-hmm. something different. And what ended up happening was I was kind of in the nonprofit world doing things that were close, connected, and related to education. And one day I got a call that my oldest son was being suspended mm-hmm. from preschool, and it like shook my life up. And shortly after, I got a call that my middle son, they were both 4 and 3 at the time, was being sent home from preschool. And again, you know, you have this moment where you remember it as if it was yesterday, and you know that your life will never be the same. And so for me, when my kids were suspended in 2014, I knew how to write, mm-hmm. right? That was my skill. I talked about, you know, a career in journalism. And so I wrote about my experience of having young children, young Black boys that were being sent home and suspended from school. And since then, I've never looked back because I learned that this was something that was happening all over the country, right? To young Black children everywhere, in every pocket and part of the United States. And the journalist in me, right, the storyteller in me knew that you couldn't simply just look away and figure it out for your kids. I had to figure out how are we going to eradicate the disparities that we were seeing.
Yes, 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 yes. And exactly as you mentioned, this happens all over the United States. And you know, people are becoming more aware of, you know, the concept of the school to prison pipeline. And they're becoming more aware of punitive practices in education. And so it's still fairly new in like the sense of like, you know, the common knowledge of this topic. But a lot of people, you know, when I talk about it, that this extends to preschool, that we're seeing preschoolers who are, you know, at their youngest, you know, 2 years old, right, for preschool, getting suspended and expelled from schools at these exorbitant rates, right? It's disproportionate to their total population. Yeah. and the frightening thing is that we do have data that shows that this is happening. But the frightening thing is like, we only have so much data, right? So it's only looking at a certain subset of preschools, right? So it's where we can get that data from, usually state funded or Head Starts, but there are a bunch of other schools that we're just not getting that data from. So how deep does this really go? It's
it is so deep. It's so deep.
Yes. It runs so deep. And it's like, I love hearing other people talking about this too, because again, we need to get, like, as you said, we need to storytell this. We need to bring this out and elevate this, because there are so many families that deal with this. And, you know, what do we do after that? What happens to these students after that fact, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we leave, you know, I think one of the things that stands out to me in the work that I've done since that happened to my sons was this idea that we kind of just make parents, you know, and families believe that they're the problem and their children are the problem, right? And so they don't see that data oftentimes. They don't have access to some of this high level data that's coming, even with, you know, even though it's not enough, the data that we have, it doesn't typically make it to the ground and into communities. So you're left to blame yourself and blame your kids. And what does that create in our communities and in our homes? And I think, you know, that's one of the most damning things for me, is just this idea that people are in this space of shame and they feel powerless. And we know that it's not about one individual family or child as a problem. There is a problem with this system. And I think, you know, making sure that families and communities know that, that we affirm that, that we continue to get these stories out there is incredibly important.
It is. And being able to see more of these stories, like you said, families don't just think it's just me, or there's something wrong with me or my parenting or something wrong with my children, right? That this is so much wider, so much bigger, right, than that. And it's systemic, you know, it's historical, like these things go far, far beyond, you know, our right now. So I always talk about ecological systems theory and how people sometimes they'll leap off the chrono system, like that largest little layer on the outside, how like time affects the individual and their development. And I'm like, no, don't you leave off that time. We need to be at what happened in our past, because it's going to influence what's happening in our right now and what's happening in our future. So don't leave off our chrono system. And how are your boys now? I know, you know, they've gotten older and you've been working and you've been, you know, using your activism and using your storytelling, you know, where are they now? How are they doing?
Yes, they are well. I should say that now there's three. So there were two and now there are three. And my boys, my oldest is 14 now. And so, you know, this is 10 years since he was suspended from preschool. And my middle son, he'll be 13 very soon. So again, we're coming up on 10 years for both of them since this happened. And my youngest son is 9. And they're doing well. They are thriving and flourishing. It took a lot of work. I would say that, you know, the impact of what we experienced still resonates and echoes within my body. And it's something that I actively have to work on because I think that, you know, my sons were so young that I tried to really shield them. And in a lot of the research that I've done with families, families have done that same thing where you want to shield your kids as much as you can. I had a parent tell me one time that when her child was sent home from a preschool program, she lied to him, right? And said, you weren't sent home. We're going on a vacation. We're having a day off. And she just, you know, dealt with all of the aftermath and all of the trauma that comes from that experience. And I think I tried to take a similar journey for my own kids now, right? Since so much media and so much conversation and work has been happening, my kids, you know, obviously are aware of what happened and remember to some degree, especially my four-year-old, what happened. He is much more conscious because he was four and he would turn five a few months later. So his memory was just a lot better and brain a lot more developed than that of my three-year-old who had just turned 3 years old when this happened. So, but they're good, right? Like they get to experience so much joy. A lot of joy that when I was a young person, I didn't get to always experience. I was also suspended from preschool and expelled from preschool. So I just think about how different their lives were, which is a testament, I believe, to, you know, some of the work that has been done. When I was a young person, my mother didn't, you know, there was no data being released. There weren't a lot of people that were in the media speaking about these issues. So she was just kind of left to her own to try to figure out what to do. And she did the best she could, but she had no support or resources. And so I look now where, you know, I've been able to really try to push and advocate for my kids and for other kids all over the country. And that has had a very powerful impact on their lives. And so they have not been suspended since preschool. So since the year 2014, no suspension. And so I'm very, very thankful for that. And I also recognize that, again, it's not enough for my boys to only experience this joy and this full life that they've been able to live since then. We have to make that so for families everywhere. Every Black boy, every Black girl, every Black child deserves to grow up with innocence and joy and curiosity. And so, I mean, the work continues.
Yes, it does. That makes my heart so happy. You know, thinking about my experiences in school growing up and being in, you know, very predominantly white spaces and what that felt like for me and my identity and, you know, the perception of me from my teachers and how that was impacting me as well. So that makes my inner child feel very warm and happy. So thank you.
Yes, it makes my inner child. Yes. There is healing for all of us when our kids and the young people coming, you know, after us have these great experiences. There's been so much healing for me as well.
And it just, yes, I love seeing just our Blackness being affirmed, our culture being affirmed. You know, there's still a lot of work to do, as you and I both know, as we're both in this space of working towards, you know, the future that we know that our children need and deserve and our teachers need and deserve. But it does feel good to see those like positive moments of like, okay, we're doing work. It's happening.
And I should say, I didn't say that this journey's been easy over these past 10 years since 2014. They haven't been sent home or suspended, but, you know, to be a Black mother of Black young folks in this country is to be, you know, to kind of wordsmith a little bit of James Baldwin, you're constantly in rage, right? Like you're always working. You're always, it may not be suspension. It may be a curriculum thing, right? It may be the way that, it may be language and the way someone is talking about your child. So that continues. I mean, people wonder why I'm counting down until they're out of these school systems. It's not because I want them to grow up. It's because it's exhausting. So there are, you know, might not be the traditional school to prison pipeline stuff, but there's all these things that are intertwined and in between that are trying to take the spirit out of our young folks. Yes. And so I think, you know, it's been a 10 years of a lot of work. I think, you know, at home is where I get to see all of the joy. And, you know, right now, sometimes you got to take the systems as they are while you're actively working. They are full. They are, their cups are being filled every day. And it might not always come from educational spaces. So we've been very intentional. They've had some good educational experiences, some trying educational experiences. We've tried out a lot of different things. But I think the main thing is that we've been trying to cultivate so much love and joy in our home and in our community. And I think that's really where I lean when I hear how they're doing. I don't always think about school, I just think about who they are as whole individuals outside of school.
Yes. And that connects a lot with a book that I remember reading from Bell Hooks, who's just, I love her writing.
Bell Hooks, my favorite writer.
Yes. So much Bell Hooks is just on the shelf behind me. But she does have that Community of Hope book, that kind of pedagogy of hope. And it does go into those spaces that mm-hmm. we learn from, but might not be traditional, you know, classroom settings. And they might be within our community. They yes. might be, you know, at a church. They might be, you know, at peer groups. They might yes. be, you know, drama club. Like, there's so many other spaces that we do get our learning. And, mm-hmm. you know, I come from a background of early childhood education. So when I think about success in early childhood education, I'm looking at their social emotional skills. I'm looking at, do you have empathy, compassion? Yeah. Can you socialize with other children? I could genuinely care less if at the end of your preschool experience, you can write your name. If you can do that, amazing. I love that for you. But yeah, I am more yeah. concerned with how are you as a person? And how are you yes, socially yes. and emotionally? And sometimes that gets a little bit lost in our very traditional K-12 system. You know, there's a lot of things that teachers have to focus on, and a lot of, you know, testing and test scores and curriculum. And there's just so many things that teachers have to do, understandably so, right? But then mm-hmm. we lose some of those elements of our personhood. And a lot of times that comes from yes. our extracurriculars, our things that we do outside of that. It's unfortunate that it has to come from that,
absolutely.
Right? In my reimagined world of education, right? It's incorporated into our education system. But right now, that's not a
that's
thing.
That's right. yeah. And teachers have those same sort yes. of reimaginings, yes. right? Those freedom dreams yes. for education. You know, I do a lot of work with teachers. And in my work with teachers, like, teachers always mm-hmm. give me hope. We just have to somehow shift away from, you know, politician-centered education, because that's what yeah. we have. And if we shift away from that and get closer to the young people, who the teachers are yeah. closer to, right? They're being forced to do things that go against who mm-hmm. they are. I think that we can have that. And I think we ought to be working toward that, because our kids deserve that. But also the adults who have, you know, given themselves in this way to be of service to young people, they deserve those type
yes,
of schools too.
Yes. I think, you know, when I spoke with Tanisha Jones on this podcast, she said something that really just impacted me so deeply into my core, that it's not, you know, teachers aren't just experiencing burnout. They're experiencing this moral kind of degradation, right? And so there's things that they have to do that are outside of their moral obligations, things that they feel like this doesn't feel right, you know? And
yes.
how that leads to people leaving the field. We have this mass exodus in education, well, probably because of that moral kind of degradation of what they know and believe in their heart and souls for education to be, and they don't have the space to cultivate that, right? And so, you know, what do you do in that situation? You can either stay in it and eventually lead yourself into this really deep, dark burnout, or you leave. You know, we're losing so many amazing educators
yeah.
who are passionate, who are creative, who have these really great ideas for what education looks like, and we're not giving them the space to do that. And so it's really
that's
upsetting
right.
to see. I've seen so many educators, you know, in my life that I've worked with, that I've, you know, looked up to, who either, especially after 2020, you know, retired, left the field, or off doing other things, like, just got
yeah.
so burnt out that they can't continue. It's hard.
It's hard.
I want to connect back to something that you mentioned previously. You said something about freedom dreams. Do you want to explain that a little bit to the audience?
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I am a freedom dreamer. I am thankful that Robin Kelly, who is a professor at UCLA, you know, who is the first that I know mm-hmm. to coin that term. And he really, you know, he has a book where he really looked at the freedom dreams of enslaved Black people. And it was this idea that they didn't just come together around struggle, which we absolutely know that they did, but they also came together around, you know, joy and opportunities to freedom dream of something more than their current state. And I think that that's a powerful message for us right now, right? We are in a strange and odd time in our society where there are laws being passed that could be more anti-Black than what we've seen during periods of time that, you know, Dr. Kelly was referencing. And so I think the ability to be able to freedom dream, to come together knowing that, yes, we have a struggle in front of us, but there is also opportunities for us to reimagine something more. And he has this quote in his book that I absolutely love. And he says, without new visions, we don't know what to build, only what to tear down. And so freedom dreaming almost as this act of resistance and this act that moves and shifts us closer to liberation is just really powerful and important. And so I try to spend as much time as I can, not only naming, critiquing, and fighting against a lot of the injustices and inequities that we see in society, I actively have to make time to reimagine and freedom dream about what I want, about what we want. And so I just think it's a powerful practice. And I encourage people to, you know, center your freedom dreams.
Yes. And what I love most about that is that it, one, acknowledges that we do have a struggle directly in front of us, right? And I think that's important for us to acknowledge, especially for those who are actively being, you know, impacted by the struggle. And it's important for us to acknowledge that I see that. And it's also giving a framework for hope, right? It's giving this framework for harm is being done. And what do we do now? How do we get out of it? And giving you that you're actively a part of this, right? So many beautiful things about that. And I want to read this book now.
Yeah. Freedom Dreams is, everything about it. And I just think it's important. And like I said, this act of resistance, this act of liberation, like to just know, you know, the freedom that we desire is not what we currently have. But how do we begin to reimagine what that looks like? I think it's a powerful practice.
It's such a powerful practice. And it really does get us thinking, and it gets our communities thinking, and it gets us actively involved and actively engaged in what the future of that looks like. And how empowering that feels and how liberating that feels to think about it and see those action steps and make those plans of like, okay, here's the problem. Here's where we want to be. Now, how do we get there? And providing those steps is so, so, so important. So I love that idea. And I love bringing that into schools. I love doing that with children. I love just doing that with teachers. Like that is such a beautiful practice.
Yes.
And so, you know, speaking of acknowledging, you know, the issues within education, I know we talked about the school to prison pipeline and punitive discipline practices, which are pretty big concepts, right? And it, you know, the harm that that causes. But what do you think kind of within that realm are some of like the biggest challenges facing education today?
Well, I think there are a number of things, that are creating issues in education, and some of that is historical. And so I'll name off a couple, but it's not exhaustive. I just want to start by saying it's not exhaustive. I feel like we could take the entire session. We know that only about 6% of all teachers are Black teachers. And I think that desegregation, which we hoped it would be integration, but it was just a form of desegregation. I still feel like we are kind of dealing with the residue of desegregation and the failed promises of desegregation. So we had, you know, we lost anywhere between 30,000 and 50,000 Black teachers and Black educators during that time. And I think, you know, that's been a very, very tough thing for us that we talk about wanting to bring more in the field, but I don't think we talk enough about what we lost. So not just the physical presence of someone Black in a space and not just representation, but we lost pedagogy, right? We lost curriculum and instruction, right? Like we lost innovation, right? And creativity. We lost, you know, ways of being and knowing that just could be so central to education that we see right now. I also think, you know, we live in a testing culture in society. And I think that that is a really big thing because, and I think it's connected to some of the things we see with behavior, because there's so much pressure on a child to sit still, right, to be able to learn this thing so that eventually they take this test, do well, and schools will not be blamed, right? Schools will not, like, so there's just this control, compliance sort of culture. And I think that there's testing at the root of it. There's, you know, I think that we have folks, we have mixed bag of politicians who may not believe in public education, right? Like as a right. And I think that that, and I'm jumping around a bit, but it makes me think about the purpose of school. And I think we're at that place again, like we've always been thinking, you know, the purpose of school, the purpose, if we think about the purpose of a lot of schools, you know, and programming that was for Black, you know, for Black people before desegregation, it had this communal piece, right? It had this liberatory piece. It was this, if you learn this, like you're unfit to be a slave, right? Like there was, you can lift your community up. Like you can do these things. If we go back to pre-colonial Africa, right? Like, and all around the world, like we can see at the purpose of education. However, colonialized, you know, United States, education had a very different purpose, right? It was not at all connected to the indigenous folks of this land. It was not connected at all to, you know, pre-colonial Africa. And so you saw that it was, you know, wealthy white males being able to be educated to do some things for their, you know, for their lives and their families. And everybody else, it was almost like, let's assimilate. Let's take everything away from them, strip them of what they know. Let's program them so that they can then work for us, right? And I think we haven't undone that yet, where, you know, school is a lot of times still about assimilation, not at all comparing it to Indian boarding schools, as we know that were so harmful and traumatic and toxic. But we still see, you know, things where we have hair, right? Like, I mean, speak about, you know, the state of Texas right now, you know, a state that has the Crown Act. There is a Black boy that has been missing a lot of school because of his natural hair. Like, so again, you still see residue of that history where it's still about control, compliance. His hair is not a distraction. It's not bothering anybody. It's beautiful. My son has very similar hair. So again, like you still see those things. We see attendance laws, right? Very similar to, again, how we did where it was forced upon you to send your kids to a form of schooling or pay a fine, be in trouble, whatever it was. And we continue to see those very things. So I think we are obsessed with compliance and, you know, controlling some of these things. And that's how we get school to prison pipeline. That's how we get burned out teachers, right? Because you, it's not really about the profession of teaching. Like you're closer to cops and security guards and some of those other things that you didn't sign up for that. Right. And so, right. Like, and I think if those are some of the challenges that I see, I mean, of course we got book bans happening right now. We have, you know, curriculum being changed. Like, it could go on and on and on again with all of the challenges. But I think at the root of it, it's about assimilation, control, and compliance. And I think we have to be willing to reckon with those things if we want to see anything different. Yes.
So much of what you said was so just right on cue and so amazing, because it's at the heart of it, that is what it is. And the harm that that creates, because we are, you know, shutting people down. We're shutting down those thoughts. You know, we're focusing too much on compliance. We're focusing too much on these very traditional ideas about discipline. All right, if I need you to listen to me, then I need to make you do this, or I need to do these kind of steps to make you listen to me, when that hasn't worked. It hasn't been working and will continue to not work. Right. And so that's why we have, like you said, these ideas of the school to prison pipeline, is that, well, I'm going to make you sit down and I'm going to make you listen and I'm going to make you learn and I'm going to make you do this. And obviously that doesn't work for a majority of people, right? This kind of scare tactics, they don't work for a majority of people, and they don't actually get us to learn. They don't actually get us to connect. They don't actually get us to develop empathy and compassion and care for one another. It actually divides us more. And so we think more punitive, we have to get more punitive, right? And so we've been seeing that shift over the last couple of years after, you know, we had No Child Left Behind. And although the intentions of that were somewhat positive, the impact of that was just disastrous for education. And we continue to see the impact of No Child Left Behind today. And we see that, you know, we're getting more punitive, more punitive, more punitive. And that pushes students until you get them into this kind of prison industrial complex, right? And by, you know, isolating people and by pushing them away and by doing that, that does not get us to the goals that we actually want to have. That doesn't actually deter behavior, right? That doesn't actually solve any issues whatsoever. It just causes more issues, and then we dig ourselves a deeper, deeper hole. And don't even get me started on the prison industrial complex, because that's just a whole other thing that's just upsetting in its own nature, right? And so it's, you know, fueled by capitalism. It's fueled, you know, like people make, but companies make so much money off of prisons, right? And so that's why they thrive. And it's under this guise of like, oh, it's for safety, you know? It's like, it doesn't keep anyone safe. In fact, it jeopardizes our health and safety more. So, you know, and like we have the data, we have the numbers to show that, right? Not only do we have people telling us this from their own lived experience of what's happening, but no one wants to listen to that. We have actual data that shows us that this is not working, but that data doesn't make us money. So it's a whole other thing. And so it's very upsetting. But so in terms of those issues and those challenges that we're seeing, you know, through your kind of research that you've been doing and the work that you've done, you know, what are some ways that we are overcoming this, or some actions that are actually kind of being working in communities? What's happening and what's working?
I don't want to be cynical, but I mean, it does matter what state you are in. It doesn't guarantee that you're going to be in a perfect place, right? Like, we can look at a state like California, who, you know, traditionally has had pretty progressive leadership that is really trying to think about, you know, wants to do better by education, wants to see, you know, communities having access to those, some of the, those basic needs, but continues to struggle, right? Like, still. So I do think state matters a ton. Especially when you think about education and the power of states. But I will say that, you know, I've been working on a new project. It's we're thinking about an ideal elementary and just really focusing in on the early grades and thinking about, like, not as a cookie cutter or a one size fits all, but like, what are some of these ingredients of an early grade elementary school that really centers like who students are? And that's from everything of thinking about like the physical design, right, of a school. They shouldn't look anything like prisons. They should look much closer to children's museums, right? And so again, like thinking about the pedagogy, the vision and philosophy, right? So again, getting to the core of the purpose of what schools were created for. So we've been working on this project for the past year or so, and now we're starting to look at like, what are some of the district level enablers or state level, and really starting to kind of fold out like, what will it take for us to move toward this more equitable, hopefully at some point liberatory sort of education for young people? And I think it's a combination of things. I think number one, I think that we need people who are, you know, in public office that actually care about public education. And I will say, like, I've worked across school contexts, right? I've been in independent school settings. I've been in public school settings. So this is not a war of private, you know, traditional public or charter. This is saying that if we have a strong public education system, every other form of education will also be strong. So like, be where it makes sense for you to be. And also see that building up public education ought to be a civil right. Yes. Like, it ought to be, it is a public good. It's something that we absolutely must have. So I think getting people in public offices who feel that way, and I don't want to be that, you know, that person that's telling everybody, we got to vote, we got to vote, we got to do this. Yeah. That's a part of it. And it's not complete, because we also have to put people in positions where they can run and be elected. Because, right, like, sometimes our options, right, and, you know, again, like, you don't, you know, I don't want to get on a whole rant about politics, but we need better people running, right? Like, I have, and I'm talking about everything from, you know, school board on up. We need better people running. And I think, you know, that takes money, right? Like, I've, you know, elections all over are incredibly expensive, even for a school board, which is always an interesting thing to me and sheds light on just how political education is. So that's number one. I will also say, to me, the most important role that I've seen in education is that of the principal, right? It is absolutely essential, important. You can find a lot of good teachers in this country. There are some phenomenal teachers. You will not find nearly as many good principals. Like, it is hard. It is complicated, right? Because you have all of these, you're trying to be student-centered. You want to please families. You want to please teachers. You want to please other workers who are not teachers, right? Like, you got to please the districts. The districts got to please states. So it is incredibly demanding, but we got to start fostering better principals. And we got to look at those examples that are just extraordinary and not just say, here, you win an award, but like, how are we using their expertise and centering their expertise to cultivate more excellent principals? And so I think about that a lot. You know, I was working with several schools in Los Angeles, California, and there was one principal who, Dr. Davis, was phenomenal. She was at Baldwin Hills in Los Angeles for a very long time. The best principal I've ever seen in my life. And I've been all over the country, literally to date, the best principal I've ever seen in my entire life. Everybody should know that name. Right. Everybody should. She should be so overwhelmed because she figured it out. Right. And figured it out in a part of LA where they didn't have access to every single thing. Right. They weren't just overwhelmed in wealth and money. Right. A Title I school. She figured it out. We ought to figure out like how we center that expertise. And I know she's not the only one, but as an example. So I do feel like one of the most important things that we can do is to lift up the good examples, not to pat them on the back. We should give people their flowers, but to say, hey, let's bring everybody together and start thinking about what is allowing this success. We don't do that. Districts don't do that, right? Like, I mean, we drop the ball oftentimes and we'll celebrate those that are doing good. And we'll shake our head and point our fingers at the ones at schools that, you know, are not, where we say they ought to be, quote unquote. But it's like, how are we really centering the good examples and creating collaboration across amongst schools and districts? I think that's a powerful opportunity. And I think that the last thing that I would say is that, which I think is very powerful, that parents and teachers and families and teachers need to come together and form an alliance. I think that folks who don't want public education and who are divisive when it comes to public education have been really good at creating division between teachers and parents. Mm. I think that there is obviously a history there, and that history is very racial and racialized. So I won't get extremely political with it. I think that teachers unions in the past have dropped the ball on what that looks like. And I think that there's an opportunity for parents and practitioners on the ground, our teachers, to say, like, if we came together with our voices, there's so much power and movement in that. And I think that has to be the way forward, that it has to be, let's figure this out, which means we may have to deal with some tension, right, that's present, some history that continues to echo, right, and, you know, today. But I think that, to me, that's the way forward. It's the only way forward. Young people at the center of that as well. Like, there are young people who have been on fire. We've seen that, you know, especially in recent years, last 10 years with different protests and movements of young people really stepping up and speaking up. And I feel like it's time for adults to get behind that leadership. We've done enough. We've made a mess. But young people are where I find the most inspiration and the most consciousness, right? And so it's time for us to like follow that lead and get behind each other. But it's not going to be easy, right? Like education, you got to think about, you know, how long we've had a system like this. So it's not something that I think, you know, we'll do overnight. It may, you know, but I think at the same time, we can't continue to do the same thing and expect a different result. So I definitely think that there is power in numbers and there's power with the people. I hope that we can see that and not just sit on the sidelines, but get off the porch actively into the streets. And that even if it needs to be like community, you know, fundraising for folks to be able to run, we need better people, right? Like, we absolutely must have better people, because if we look at how marginalization is maintained and enforced, that's through policy, right? It's through lots of policy and laws that are being made and passed every single day. And so I think we are going to have very different energy in some of these high positions.
Yes, 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 yes. I love the aspect that you mentioned about community, you know, teachers and educators and parents and students, right? Forming that community together. Because in a lot of ways, we're all in this together. We're all, you know, going through the system, which is, you know, working the exact way that it was supposed to be designed, you know? So it's designed to be this way. It's designed to have that barrier of entry for some of these, like, kind of higher level positions, higher level policy positions. And it's designed that way on purpose. And so when we form community together and when we work together for that common cause, it can kind of help us to get liberated and get beyond some of those barriers, right? Because we do need, you know, we need more thought within our school boards. We need more thought and we need more diverse voices within, you know, higher education and within, you know, admin positions, right? So, you know, you look at, again, the data, you pull that up and you see that there's a lot of, you know, women identified, people who identified as women. And there's a lot of people of color within education, especially early childhood. It is, there's a lot of, you know, women of color within early childhood education, especially K through 12 education, a lot of female teachers. But then you look at the divide of admin positions, right? So principals, vice principal, at the higher level you get, it's, where did all these men come from?
Superintendent.
Where do all these men come from?
Y'all got time to be a superintendent.
Yeah. It's like, I'm working with all of these really amazing women and with all these amazing young people. And I'm like, why are all these men up here? If all of these women are in the field.
Board members, superintendents, they want to be the one telling you what to do and how to do it. But I'm not, not doing it. I agree. I think it's very interesting when you see
the
data.
The data tells a story. And again, us with our lived experience, we see it and we can point it out, like, hey, this ain't right, right? But sometimes they're not listening unless they see, like, the actual numbers on the page, like, wow, this is a lot. It's like, yeah, we've been saying that for a minute here. But yeah, when we are able to form community and band together, and especially as you mentioned with those youth adult partnerships, they are tricky, right? Because, you know, when, as we get older and we, you know, are working and we're learning about bureaucracy and we just kind of know how things work, and it sucks that this is the way that things work sometimes, but, you know, you gain that understanding and you start knowing how to navigate the bureaucracy, you know, how to navigate certain things just as you've had more experience doing those things, right? But our youth bring so much fresh voice, fresh ideas. They bring so much beauty to the conversation, right? So just because they lack experience doesn't mean that they don't belong still at the table with us, because they have these amazing ideas. They have this, you know, this freshness about them. You know, they have all this drive about them that hasn't been, you know, chiseled away by bureaucracy in the same way that as we get older, it does. But forming those partnerships between youth and adults, they're tricky and there's a lot of things you need to navigate, but it forms such a beautiful partnership where we're elevating these really great ideas and we're working with them through our experience of, like, okay, you have these ideas. This is the steps that we go through to make that a reality, or this is who we need to talk to. This is where they need to go. This is the partnerships we need to make. And we can see some really beautiful shifts in education when we do that, right? Because this is the future that we're going to be leaving them, you know, for the most part, at the end of the day, right? They're the ones who are going to have to deal with the mess that we've made and that we're leaving them. So why should they not have a say in how we mitigate these issues and how we solve these issues and how we make the world a better place for future generations to continue to come up through?
Yeah. And I think, you know, we should look for good examples for that. You know, I know the Youth Mentoring Action Network, they have a phenomenal model for how they follow the lead of young people. Right. There are absolutely good models of everything that we want to do around us if we are humble enough, open enough, thoughtful enough, and intentional enough to make it happen.
Exactly. 100%. We can do it, but there needs to be intention and thoughtfulness to it.
Yes, we can.
I know you kind of already talked about this, but how do you reimagine the education system?
How do I reimagine the education system? Gosh, that's I love the question, and I think, you know, just I first think about the philosophy, right, of education, just like why are we coming together? And I think, you know, we've and there's a lot of layers on how education looks, because I didn't even talk about childcare and all of these things, right, that contribute to how we think about education. But I would think about joy is at the root of it. So a philosophy of like kids having spaces where they can be in community with each other, to learn. And it's not this individualized, like, where you're on this journey for yourself so that you can go to college, right? Do we care about who you become after you're 18? Absolutely. We absolutely do. But we also care who our communities become after you're 18, right? Who our communities are right now. And so I think this combination, which pulls from, you know, a lot of Black education, this idea that yes, there's an individual piece, but there's also this communal piece. So we come together to learn and grow, to continue to build and flourish our communities. And so I think an education philosophy where that's at the root of it, that we are doing this not only for ourselves, but for each other, right? Our community, our local communities, and our global communities, right? So I think something like that, just at the root of it. And I would say, and we do that through play, right? And I think about accessible play so that, you know, it doesn't just have to be this ableist view of play, but play that is centered on how each, what that means for each child and community. I think about where there's a lot more flexibility in school. I think, you know, we are a really attendance driven, you know, we still give out who got perfect attendance and all of these things. And it's like, no, like who came to school whole today? Who felt well, right? I think about that, you know, education. So I see where, you know, there is this kind of mix and like, yes, you want kids to be there when it makes sense. And if there's, you know, if there are things that are keeping kids from coming to school, we know those things, right? We work together. There is a community feel. And so I guess to not like list every single aspect, because I could, I think it's this communal piece that's missing from schools, that like everybody has a connection to it, that's a part of the community, whether you have children of your own or not. You feel that it is this place where learning takes place. And learning doesn't just look like I'm taking a test. There's not just one form of assessment, right? We think about how everybody learns best, what environments teachers teach best in, where, you know, we have the audacity to think about grades in different ways than we do. We think about different grade levels in the way that we do. I just think it has to be a humanizing thing where, you know, there are places, if we think about, I have three kids, so there are times when I can tell they can be sleep and tired. And I'll say, hey, we're going to Six Flags today, or we're going to SeaWorld today, or we're going to wherever it is today. And they're going to jump out of bed no matter how tired they are. I dream of schools that when I say we're going to school today, they jump up that way, right? Because it's fun. Yes, they get to learn. Learning should be fun. They get to be in community with people. They get quality food that matters and means something and is good for their bodies, right? Like so, and there's just a slower pace. We get to slow down, right? We get to feel good in the space where families know, like, you can sit out and hang out and there's greenery for you. And, you know, there's a yoga mat over here and over there if you want, or if you gotta go, right? Because you gotta work or you gotta do whatever. Like, we'll see you when you come back. But I just think of this flow and this ease and this communal aspect of education. I mean, that's how I reimagine it, honestly. And I want that so
I want that.
badly.
That feels so holistic. That feels so welcoming and inviting and warm and comforting. Like, I want education to feel exactly as you have listed that out. I want every day to feel like that, honestly.
Yes. And you know, speaking of bell hooks, you know, and you mentioned one of her books, but she also talks about those kind of spaces in her book Yearning. And it was that idea, like she talks about home places that, you know, it was, and they didn't always have the resources, but it was that knowing you were going into this space where you were going to be humanized and, you know, loved on, affirmed, like, how can we create educational spaces like that?
Love that. Love a good circle back to bell hooks. She's fantastic. Thank you so much for joining me. Where can my audience find you if they want to connect with you, if they want to see what you're up to?
Yes, no, I have a website. It's just TanettePowell.com. I try to stay as active as I can on Instagram. So it's just at Tanette Powell. I'm on Twitter and, you know, a bit. It's not the most place to stay updated, but I just kind of tweet thoughts, feelings, things like that. But Instagram is probably the place. I'm also, anybody can look me up and find my email. Like if you are on my website, I'm always happy to engage beyond some of these social media ways of engagement. And so always happy to have a conversation. So you can feel free to email me there. If you are a parent that's listening and you're having an experience with your child, or a family member that's having an experience with your child and you want support, like reach out to me. I really believe in the spirit of Ubuntu. I am because we are. And I think that any way that I can help or connect you with someone that's closer to where you are, like I'm here to do that. And I'm always here to do that. That's my life's work. So, and I just want to lift up all the parents who may be listening as well, because to be raising children in this state, in this space, and like when I say state, I don't mean the physical state, but like the state that we are in and have been in is no easy feat. And it is a revolutionary act to be raising, especially, you know, kids of color and kids that have been marginalized, whether, you know, for any of their social identities. So I just want to lift up all the parents. Yes,
thank you so much. And I love the connecting back to community and connecting that. I just really appreciate you for coming on to Conscious Pathways and sharing all of this amazing thought that you have. It was such a great conversation and I just can't thank you enough.
Yes, thank you so much. You're doing thank important you so work. Much. Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Conscious Pathways. Don't forget to like, share, and follow Conscious Pathways wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a rating or review. It really does help the podcast to grow and reach more listeners just like you. Feel free to follow me on social media. I have Conscious Pathways, conscious.pathways on Instagram and TikTok. If you're curious about other topics I talk about, you can look me up on LinkedIn, which is Brittany Carey. Or you can find me on YouTube where I put the video version of all of these podcasts. I look forward to connecting with you. I love hearing your thoughts, your comments, your ideas. So feel free to share those with me. And until next time, don't forget to navigate your conscious journey with courage and kindness. And I'll see you there for more transformative conversations.